International with Lee Brussel, who for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Brussel in Carmel, California. This is program number 537, March the 21st, 1982. There's an article in the newspaper yesterday. Vasily I. Chukov passed away. He was the marshal who led the defense of the Soviet Union against Nazi Germany. That was in Stalingrad. He was known for his courage. He stood up to the Germans, and he assured the Soviet Union, the officials there, Stalin, that he said, "We will hold the city or die there." That was really a turning point in history, that event, because if the Nazis had been able to take the Soviet Union, they would have been able to have captured the entire world. What they did, actually, by being turned back, was to retrench, as I've said many times, and this has been written up in very many books. They retrenched. They had meetings after the spring of 43 and decided how to get ready for the Fourth Reich, to send the money and the gold and the art, everything that was available, to be removed, the names, even fingerprints and dental records of Nazis. And Japan did the same thing when the war was winding down. They saw they couldn't win. They took all their wealth out of Japan so they'd have it to reinvest when the war was over. So by 1943, when that battle was held off and they were forced to return, they made up their minds that they would begin. I think the date right now, according to many, many books, is 1985. That will be 42 years from the time that this particular group were able to stop the Germans from invading Russia. They went on through Germany and met at the surrender in Berlin, May 1st, 1945, and the Germans surrendered to this particular general, Vasily Chukov. He came to the United States to the funeral of Eisenhower, and he passed away today. I think the people are in this country as immobilized as the Germans or any other group were that felt the pressures of the last war, whether it was England or France or Germany or Russia or Poland, Romania, and so forth. The victims and the people who suffered from the last war are willing to wage and allow the next war. And so that there's about a 42-year time span between wars. The stakes are much greater now, but unfortunately, people don't learn very much from the past. And there have been a lot of warnings about the dangers of not learning from the past, more than just those of Santayana. I'm going to update a few things about the airplane conditions. I've been doing this ever since Air Florida crashed January 13th. In the Potomac in Washington, D.C. at National Airport right after leaving there. But there's some very important articles on the airlines. And the airlines are significant, one, because if they have air wars and planes are bombed or crash, we are the victims if we're on those planes or relatives or friends. And it interrupts terribly the security of people flying across this nation or out of the nation or back and forth. But the control of routes is important. I wrote an article, I believe it was in the Berkeley Barb in 1974. I think the title of the article was, "Is Donald DeFries the First Black Lee Harvey Oswald?" And I wrote it several weeks before the burning in Los Angeles by the SWAT team of members of the SLA that was created by the CIA. I just wrote that several weeks before he was killed, saying that he would be sacrificed to cover up the CIA involvement in the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. And in that article, I mentioned the danger of the Dallas-Fort Worth airport that had just opened, that it was larger than it ever had to be to transport the kind of traffic we need in this country. But the large airplanes could arrive in there and remove large masses of transport of people out of this country, down specifically to South America or out of the country for mass extermination, airlifting them, I suspect, at the Dallas-Fort Worth airports. And at the time of Watergate, there were memos and documents that the Attorney General, John Mitchell, and G. Gordon Liddy, and E. Howard Hunt, and Richard Nixon had planned to airlift and kidnap radicals or anti-war protesters and take them out of the country. They didn't say what country, but they were to be flown out of the country. So the intent was there. and I suspected the airport. So it is very important to know the ways that you would escape. We think we're a large country that we can go from state to state or out of the country, or like certain people did during the Vietnam War, to Canada. But when there's inflation and you don't have money, if airline tickets are $500 or $600, if you can't get a seat on a particular plane, if you can't get out, if the monopoly is in four airlines and the routes are divided between those four, you're not going to get anywhere, even if you wanted to. If the people who intend to control want to, they can control through food, transportation, housing, and a lot of ways, and transportation is an important one. There's an article in San Jose News that was sent to me by a very fine investigator up in the Bay Area. This is March the 12th, 1982. It was taken from the Hartford Courant. Computer reservation systems are drafted into the airline war. And this, the gist of this article is that the computer systems will be put in to make reservations and could combine data for four major airlines while excluding all other airlines. And they name American Airlines, Eastern Airlines, TWA, and British Airlines that are used by the American Express already, that they have a way of using the computer where they, if you call in for reservations to go to different places, they put you on one of these four. There are 60 American Express offices. Eventually, there'll be 1,000. And the article says the computer reservation system is vital to travel agents who have to know time flights, and they have to have access to information immediately. But if the computer that is put in the travel agent office is controlled by the airlines, if they supply the computer, you will only tap into those particular airlines. There's the American computer, the United computer, and the rivalry, according to this article, is going to the computers. If you switch from one airline company to the other, the computers provide data on flights of rivals of airlines that come in. But they don't have the latest prices being offered by competing airlines. And if they don't turn you into a travel package of the airlines that charge less, the smaller airlines that are trying to make it go, then the small ones go broke. And this is a story of the computer war of excluding all but four major airlines and the travel agents tapping into those four. There was another article, March the 20th, the Los Angeles Times. Pan America plans a feeder system of small lines. Now, Pan America was in great trouble financially, lost many millions of dollars, but they are going to plan a network of small computer airlines. They want 25% of Golden West at headquarters in Newport Beach. Another editorial in the Monterey Herald this last week, The Unfriendly Skies, urging an investigation of the charges that I had on the air last week that American Airlines was engaged in tactics to eliminate the Braniff airline as competitor. Now, Braniff is the airline that has the South American flights. Mostly, they have right now Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, Paraguay, Brazil. And Pan Am wants the control of these flights. They already have Rio de Janeiro, San Paulo, Brazil, Montevideo, Uruguay, Buenos Aires, Argentina, and Santiago, Chile. And if Pan Am takes control of Braniff Airline that they want to do, they will have all of South America, one airline. Now, one article in the Monterey Herald and also the Associated Press says that other airlines are strongly interested in the Braniff airline. If that route from South America, if Braniff goes broke, Air Florida, the very airline that crashed, that began my radio analysis of the airline problems, wants the route of South America, and so does Eastern Airline. Air Florida wanted Western Airline and was going to put in a bid when Neil Berg stepped in and assumed control of Western Airline as of October of last year. Air Florida wants South American routes if Braniff goes off, and Pan Am wants to pay them $40 million and grab all South American airline routes. The head of Air Florida had gone to Pan Am just this last fall, and American is admitted, according to their officials in the paper this week, that they want Braniff out of the running so that Pan Am could have that route. And the Braniff executive, one of their main executives, just went to work for Pan Am. If that sounds a little complicated for you, the names of the airlines and the jumping around, It is complicated, and I've charted it, and maybe I can make it a little simpler. But Air Florida immediately filed a request to object to the intention of Pan Am to take Braniff Airline. They said those routes are not their private property. They are U.S. routes, according to their spokesman in Miami. And Eastern Airlines said that would make Pan Am the exclusive U.S. carrier to South America. Now, that is very dangerous to allow one airline to have every city, with the exception of Venezuela. There's one other plane company that goes in there. That the only way to get to South America or get out of South America is one airline, and Pan Am was the airline that was the grandmother of Air America and Flying Tigers. They all were branches, a nucleus. They came off of that just as Linden Industry came off of Hughes Aircraft and spun out from that. These other CIA airlines came out from Pan Am, and Pan Am was named in the Torbett document as being part of an integral part of the assassination teams and the hanky-panky that went on between various elements, including those Nazis in South America. And this route would be a total control of South America with one airline. And I don't think it would take too long to explain the complications of giving them that kind of power. There was an article this week, why wasn't the low-flying plane Air California warned at the Ontario Airport? I mentioned last week the problem of them all. They're almost having an accident coming in from Seattle and Oakland February the 15th, the exact anniversary of the Air Florida, 1 month later. Another private airline company, a small one, AirCal, almost crashed their 737. They said, investigating it, they said, was it a problem with the computer? This article asked in the paper last week, did they have equipment malfunction? Did the control, did the pilots not read the controls right? The pilot and co-pilot were suspended. Luckily, there were no injuries. They skidded off the end of the road, just like the World Airways did in Boston. Even without snow, they skidded off. And there was an article, why and did this happen? How did it happen? Also, World Airways has $15 million loss in 1981. That was this last week. Los Angeles Herald Examiner. And then another article, Pan Am shows airlines may be down and not out. And this is from the Los Angeles Herald Examiner again, saying that Pan Am had a tremendous burst of energy this last week. Now, remember, the president of Air Florida went to Pan Am just this last fall, and the president of Braniff went to Pan Am, and Pan Am wants the only road so that the small airlines, Air Florida and Braniff going down, or World Airways going down, or AirCal, these little guys could be pushed out, and then one airline controls this entire maze of South America. The article in the Los Angeles Herald said yesterday Pan Am filed a petition to take over Braniff Airways South America operation for the next 4 years. On Tuesday, they asked for a 25% interest in the purchase of Golden West, the computer airlines. Also Tuesday, Pan Am hired Braniff's chairman, John Casey. And John Casey, who left Braniff to go over to Pan Am, his brother is the chairman of American Airlines. And as again, I say, that gets complicated, but it comes out like a sledgehammer on your head if you really analyze the manipulations that are going on that will affect all of us. Now, this article in the Herald, Los Angeles Herald, says Pan Am has a reasonable amount of cash right now. Remember, they were supposed to have lost like $384 million last year. They have cash now. They sold some hotels, said Anthony Lowe Beer, a New York-based analyst for L.I.F. Rothschild, Unterberg Tobin, wherever he's located, or an organization overseas in Europe, the Rothschilds and Unterberg Tobin, and they refer in this article to Ed Acker, who's now head of Pan Am, who left Air Florida. And they've sold their Intercontinental Hotel Corporation to Grand Metropolitan of London for $500 million. Now, these airlines, like Neil Berg coming down to Western Airline, he picks up $50 million, or I mentioned Kirk Kerkorian buying MGM and putting up $500 million. When Pan Am wants the money, they take the executive from Braniff, they take the executive from Air Florida, And the brother of one of those is still head of American Airlines, who wanted Braniff out of business. And you get a manipulation here where there's the total control of a route. Another article in the Los Angeles Herald, World Airways may be the first victim of the low fare wars. World Airways, as I say, had that problem in Boston, and they have expensive lawsuits on that accident, even though two are missing and dead. There are not too many suing, but there will be multi-million dollar lawsuits on that. Air Florida has the large amount of lawsuits and complications of the crash in the Potomac from National Airport. And Braniff was supposed to have a bomb on the plane. Luckily, it didn't explode, but it was set to explode. And I'll do a little bit more on that bomb that I mentioned last week. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal. John J. Kerry quit Braniff and joins Pan Am, as I mentioned before. And John J. Casey, whose brother is still head of American Airlines. I charted it out in a way, it would be hard if you remember because they're new names, but it involves, say, the major airlines, American Airline, Braniff Airline, Pan American Airline, Air Florida, and World Airways, and then Western that I've done several radio programs on. But in American Airlines, there's Al Casey, the chairman, who admits he wants Braniff Airlines out of the business. And his brother, who was chairman of Braniff Airlines, that is going broke, that has those juicy routes in South America, and believe me, it's scary as hell, his brother goes over to Pan Am, and they want to pay off and buy the Braniff route. So you have one brother, John Casey, at Pan Am, and the other brother, Al Casey, at American Airlines, and Braniff in the middle with routes, I repeat again, between New Orleans, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, Paraguay, Brazil, all of South America, Uruguay, and the major cities of South America. So Braniff gets closed out, and the two brothers, one's at Pan Am and the other's at American. And Braniff almost had a bomb on their plane last week by an Air Force man, and just by the grace of God, the thing didn't get off and he was arrested. But Braniff would have had more trouble with a bomb on a plane. Then with Air Florida, Mr. Acker goes to become head of Pan Am to go over to there. Air Florida has this accident in Washington, D.C. And before Edward Acker worked for Air Florida, he was chairman at Braniff Airline with John Casey. So Air Florida is expendable or can be on these routes and crashed out when they wanted a bid for the Braniff routes in South America. And the small companies that would be squeezed would be World Airways, Air Florida, and Braniff. And all three of them had a near tragedy, and the other two had accidents, one on the runway in Boston and one in Washington, D.C. Now, there was an article I saw this week, neo-Nazis invite patriots to Paraguay. And this isn't far removed from the control of the routes in and out of South America. This is efforts of former Nazis, and it doesn't mean they're not present Nazis, to find haven in South America has received a new twist. There are advertisements in newspapers in Germany and in Austria. Come down to Paraguay, South America is the long-cherished cherished refuge of Nazis who fled Europe immediately after Hitler, this article says. They're now running ads, come down to Paraguay. The economic scene is good. They will promote physical and economic advantages. And Paraguay is where Nazi Joseph Mengele, who ran the extermination camps at Auschwitz for Mr. Otto Ambrose, the partner of Grace, the appointee of Reagan, I mentioned last week. Mengele's is down there sterilizing almost all the Indian population at the present time. I'll give you the books next week. Sources of Information is a book that came out in Boston on Mengele's and the sterilization, and he has also worked for the CIA and experimented with radiation for the CIA. His headquarters are down in Paraguay. Reverend Moon was supposed to have just been dumping about $350 million of his CIA ammunition money down in Paraguay, and this again will be parlayed into some more fascism of an extermination down in Paraguay. Now, there are ads in Europe, in Germany, And the State Department, our State Department and Defense Department are getting ready for World War III. And the Nazis that went down to South America before or after are bringing the other ones or encouraging them, put your money in, buy a home, real estate. They'll let the Americans fight it out in Central America like we did in Southeast Asia, increase our debt, the dead, the Agent Orange, the chemicals. They'll let us have the fun fighting it between each other, and they're going to sit down on the estates in these various countries that they have, and they are estates, and they've lived very finely, these war criminals that walked right out of Europe down. They've lived in Paris and in Italy and Spain and Ireland and Middle East, and they're down in South America, and they are the core of the countries down there of Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, and so forth. And they're down there now, and the ads in Europe, come on down, bring your money, and get settled in Paraguay. And if you read these things carefully and you don't ignore them, you realize that the pattern that happened before World War II is the same thing that's happening now. They want to get certain people out. They call it a place for profitable capital returns and security. This is the ads in West German newspapers. They have said profitable capital returns and security. It is a politically stable zone of South America, and they advertise, you can be removed, in quotes, from the fangs of international high finance. Those, I suppose they mean, are the Jewish bankers like the Rothschilds, and I can't think of any others. They're offering real estate. Paraguay is will help you find estates and so forth, and real estate companies put ads in Nazi newspapers in Germany offering fertile, wooded, grazing land under German administration. That's Mr. Stroessner down there, under German administration. These are ads being run in Germany right now. And Pan American, that's worked with the CIA, and the CIA has funded these Nazis, given them security, helped with their protection all these years, trained their people to have the death squads in Central and South America, brought them to Panama and to Washington and to New Mexico. The United States gave them the weapons, the training to suppress, the medications to sterilize, just like the medications and the guns for Jonestown came right out of America, Stanford Research, and out of Palo Alto, California. Well, that's going on in South America. And the only route for all of that to get down there or to get out of there or to get out of this country, see, they will be secure and have their estates. They will have their money. They will have everything they need, fresh air and the comforts, while we pay the bill and fight it out. And that is what the Pentagon is planning, because we have allowed these people to come in and decide how our government would be formed after World War II. I did want to mention that man on the jet airplane before I go on to John Belushi and some other important matters. I mentioned last week that this man that was arrested in Washington, D.C., for putting a bomb on his wife's airplane came from the Air Force, that he worked at Andrews Air Force Base, and that his wife was in the military, and he put a bomb on her airplane, and when she undid her luggage when she got home, it was there, and he was arrested. But the point is that he went through National Airport, which is where Air Florida took off from, and American Airlines surfaced that plane, or was supposed to have. She got through the Dallas-Fort Worth airport fine and was going on to Wichita, Canada. But she was on a Braniff airline that didn't go off. But her husband, he's Airman First Class Martin T. Bradley, was working at Andrews Air Force Base. And I called attention to the fact that not only did she get through these places, but that the President of the United States goes through Andrews Air Force Base at least once a week, twice. If he's out of town, he departs from there, coming and going. He returns. If he's down at Camp David, he takes a helicopter there, and he goes from there, Andrews Air Force Base. Well, there were articles in the paper this week. Man facing bomb charges reported on Reagan jet crew. An Air Force enlisted man charged with planting a bomb in his wife's suitcase had potential access to President Reagan's Air Force One, according to a federal prosecutor. The Air Force denied the claim, but the prosecutor responded Thursday, said the information I reported to the court, I believe, was true. He was on the backup crew of Air Force One. he could service it. He was a serviceman at Andrews Air Force Base, where the President of the United States comes and goes. And it's this man was in the Air Force. His wife was in the Air Force. Now, the important thing about this is that these people can be tested for mind control. They can be allowed, say, to put a bomb in the suitcase of their wife and unload their wife or get rid of her and be protected from the crime if the plane blows up. They'd never suspect an Air Force man from this particular base. Andrews Air Force Base would be it. Then they would have him under control to do other crimes if they needed him to do it. And that is the way people are broken down. It's one of the ways. There are many ways that people are broken down. In a few weeks, I'll do more on a case, a murder suspect in Santa Cruz, a case that has just been in the news out here in Santa Cruz, California, where two people's bodies were found. A woman went to the FBI and police and told about it because the man that did these murders, and she was with him, threatened her and was going to dismember her and kill her. So she went to the police in Santa Cruz and told about him. His name is Royal Hayes, and he was a brilliant student up in Oregon who described as a 24-year-old scholastic wonder, self-described idealist. He's kind of like this fellow that killed Alan Lowenstein, Dennis Sweeney, came out of the same Oregon hospital, or Larry this Gilmore, who asked to die in Utah before the firing squad. He was an idealist, and he went to school, an honor student. He left school in 1962, and he confided to his wife that he had seen all there is to see and done all there is to do. And then 1 month later, he took three bullets and put them in the best friend in the stomach of his best friend, a security guard. And he said something that is important, and I'll go back to this case later, because the indication of mind control at the time, he said, "I shall," in an interview in jail at the time he killed his best friend, he said, "I shall not be the last person who, through no fault of his own, inflicts harm on somebody." And he killed his best friend, just as this Air Force man could attempt to murder his wife and these other people that would be on the plane. He was put in a mental hospital, Oregon State Hospital. He goes over the fence and leaves there. And a week later, he's in Minnesota, and he was charged with a robbery charge. He got 20 years in the state prison. He was out in 4 years, never returned back to Oregon. And then he was caught on a murder charge later in Minneapolis and had a gun in his hand. And then he was released later. And he was a real estate man in Hawaii with high up contacts. Now, the interesting thing about this story, besides the mind control and besides his being so brilliant, he had experiences. He came from a family studying music, art, and literature. He was reared in New England. He was in the Air Force after high school graduation. And this record of being in a mental hospital, leaving, killing somebody and getting off from it, killing somebody else and getting off of it. And then the part of the story that interested me is that just after his girlfriend told about him doing the murders and how she dug the grave and watched him decapitate these people and cut off the hands and heads over by the Santa Cruz campus, she led the investigators to the scene of the crime, and she said that they, after they did this, they went to Minnesota, to Minneapolis, and they met a man named Big John, and they gave him the handgun and the silencer that killed the people before they decapitated them in California, and they delivered them to a man named James Johnson. And the thing that struck me was that at the time Patty Hearst was kidnapped, in the article is the SLA, the CIA. I wrote about this James Johnson in that article in 1974. That was 8 years ago. I was referring to him, and it was in a section of the article that I wrote on the FBI and the involvement of FBI in kidnapping, and had to do with, I pulled out my file when I saw his name in the news this week and knew that he was a mind-control trained assassin. And because he had been in Minneapolis, I pulled out my article about the kidnappings. He was involved. This Johnson was a contractor who kidnapped a banker's wife. This was way back in May of 74. We're talking about 8 years ago. And he was shot in the head, and I suspected that that particular kidnapping was arranged by the FBI and that the person working with this Johnson, there was more to this story than we were told. The woman's name was Eunice Kronholm. And her husband was the president of a bank, and he put up $200,000 and released her. And this Johnson was shot in the head at the time. He survived it. But at the time of the Patty Hearst kidnapping, I knew that this particular Johnson was an important person, and I mentioned that he should be investigated further. So now, 8 years later, the fellow who's doing the hand, cutting off the hands and the decapitating, who's had this life of traveling around and being in a mental hospital, he leaves, killing one person, killing another. He bragged about doing many killings to this woman after she dug the graves for these two people and helped with these scenes. He told her he did many other killings. We won't know where they are or who they are, probably, because now they've even ruled out hypnosis as a method of getting information. But the point is that these people who are in the Air Force or not in the Air Force, who kill their best friends, kill members of their family, it's terribly important to know that they are under control, and that the stories that you read are so bizarre that if you trace them back to the hospitals and the places they were from the time they left high school and college in the Air Force, you could find a pattern that runs throughout all these cases. And as I say, it was on page 31 of my article, the SLA is the CIA. I talked about Mrs. Kronholm and this particular Johnson and James Johnson, and that should be investigated 8 years ago. I'll take a 1-minute break and get back to some more stories and the murder of John Belushi.